Welcome to a special episode of The Sanity Interview. My name is Rebecca Sugar, and I'm joined today by my co-host and now today my guest, A.R. Hoffman, who has exquisite timing. He landed in Israel a few hours, I think, A.R., before Operation Rising Lion began. And so he's there on the ground. He's been reporting for The Sun since he's been there, and he's going to give us a live update on what's happening. First of all, A.R., how are you?
Well, it's great. It's great to be here with you, Rebecca, and with all of our sanity listeners. You know, it's really remarkable. I had kind of set myself up in Tel Aviv and was enjoying the Tel Aviv lifestyle, the cafes, some of the bars, if I may say so, some of the, you know, the friendly locals, and then the world changed. Thursday night, the streets were full. Pride weekend was coming up, so you had folks visiting from all over the world. It was as vibrant as can be, and people went to bed around, you know, maybe late Thursday night. Remember, Thursday night here in Israel is a weekend night. The weekend is Friday, Saturday, so Thursday is a big night for going out. And the first sign of maybe a new world and a new Middle East came via alarm at about 3 a.m. Israelis and me got a message on their phone, right? This is an app all Israelis have called Homefront Command. But even if you don't, the government sends a message directly through your cell service to your phone, telling you to find the nearest shelter and get close to it. And then there's a subsequent message saying, okay, now you have to go in the shelter and you have a minute and a half to do so.
Did you know where the nearest shelter was at that moment?
Well, that's a great question. I had seen a sign on the street. I kind of registered it in a sort of offhand way, partially because there had been one siren before from a Houthi missile, but it was kind of a one-off. And I had never done this before. You know, for Israelis, it's kind of a part of life. But I think, and maybe we'll get to this in a bit, Rebecca, but even for Israelis, this feels different. This feels a difference not only of degree, but of kind. Anyway, that first night, got to the shelter, and think of a, you know, Churchill's bunker, or, you know, the bunker under Berlin in 1945. You go down a steep set of stairs, everyone from the block is there. It's like a block party if it were underground in a concrete cell. So, of course, we know it was the opening of one of the more extraordinary military operations really in modern history, the decapitation of the entirety of the Iranian High Command and attack on nuclear sites and military facilities.
I wanted to ask you, in those first moments, you obviously didn't know everything that was happening and what this exactly was, or does the app tell you we've attacked Iran? No. What does it tell you?
No, it just tells you, and this has been a subject of some joking from Israelis who said, you know, couldn't have just been an email, you know, that first time, because, you know, but I think the government wanted to alert everyone that a war had begun, right. A preemptive war had begun. And then, you know, the next few days, I think, and again, even for Israelis have been pretty harrowing. Largely, these alerts happen at night. There have been one or two during the day, but an interesting split screen where during the day folks are. But once night begins, really people are at their homes. Rules are a little reminiscent. Talk about PTSD, Rebecca, of COVID rules. No gatherings are allowed. No non-essential stores are open. You can barely find anything to eat after about 8:30 or so. So this is, you know, for a city famous for its vibrancy, this is really a hunkered down and subdued place at the moment, even as life continues mostly during daytime hours.
And just back to the bomb shelters, I'm curious, how long do you spend in them on average typically? And what happens down there? Is there Wi-Fi? Do people have board games down there for kids? Really, like, what is it like when you're in there?
Yeah, so I've now been in two. I moved where I was saying midway through. The first one, as I mentioned, was across the street from my apartment. And remember, you get the alarm. You're supposed to get to that shelter within a minute and a half. So you have to get dressed. You have to have your shoes ready. You have to you know, if you want to take a book, let's say, you got to get that in tow. Some of the eeriest memories I'll have of this time are seeing people running to get down to bomb shelter. What Israel did after a few days of that is now they give more advance warning. So you get a warning about a half hour before 20 minutes saying, be in the range of a shelter. And then you get a second warning saying, okay, now it's time to go in, right? To kind of cut down that warning time. They really are interesting places. I mean, you know, what I began to see was after this had gone on for a few nights, parents just took sleeping bags for their kids. They said, hey, it's easier for us just to stay here rather than go back and forth. Wake up, go back to sleep, wake up, go back to sleep. But, you know, it's like any cross section of life. You know, you have old people, young people, you have dogs. The dogs may not get along, you know, things like that. I'm staying in a hotel now, and just to say, in that first one, there was no cell service, at least for me. So you would wait, and then maybe someone would get some signal, okay, the all clear, usually after around 20 or 25 minutes or so, after the missiles were intercepted. You know, just a couple other things to note. One is, you know, these have been attacks on major civilian centers. I've heard booms. I've heard the ground shake. I did a walk around today, and you know, bars and restaurants I've been to just in the past couple of days are now rubble, you know, have been hit. It very much feels close to home.
What do you think most Israelis are feeling? I post October 7th, felt like a whole country of PTSD survivors, and now there's just added anxiety. This is, as you said, of a different kind. It's not an operation. It's a war against a country, and nobody knows how long it'll take. So what's your general sense of the mood? You say people are still out during the day and on the beach, or, you know?
Yeah, I think in a way this feels like a war that all of Israelis can get behind. I'm in very liberal Tel Aviv, a place that's no fan of Prime Minister Netanyahu. You know, needless to say, the posters of hostages are up everywhere. Some of the graffiti is very critical of the prime minister for not ending the war in Gaza or bringing the hostages home. This feels different. I think this is the kind of war Israel feels, you know, is a just war, is the kind of war Israel should be fighting. I think there are a couple reasons for that. It's a war against another state. Right. I think there's a long held sense that Iran is the ultimate enemy. Right. And so they're the ones to attack. And second of all, you know, if one of the sins of October 7th was complacency or mistakes was complacency, this is an example of, you know, preemption, forethought, and taking the initiative, all, you know, qualities that I think are very attractive. Yeah. But we'll see. We'll see how long it goes on.
I think also a stark reminder right after October 7th and the failure of intelligence, you know, on the heels of the pager operation against Hezbollah, this is another reminder that Israel's Mossad, Israel's intelligence, and Israel's military are very strong. And I think that must give Israelis great confidence and great hope.
Absolutely. And just a couple of things to say about that. The first is, you know, success is cumulative, and Israel's success at neutralizing Hezbollah, their success against Hamas in Gaza sort of have made this possible, right? I mean, for a long time, the fear about war with Iran was its unleashing of Hezbollah. You know, when word came that Hezbollah would not get involved, that was a key moment, I think, in the early hours of this war. Second, absolutely. This is the kind of war, the kind of operation, the kind of strategy that, you know, that legends are built of, right? The Mossad building a drone camp in Iran, right? Commandos on the ground, you know, carrying out assassinations. I mean, eliminating the entirety of Iran's high command in a matter of hours. I mean, these are the kinds of almost miraculous achievement. But of course, they're not miracles. They're the product of Israel's ingenuity and its creativity and its strategic thinking. And obviously, this was planned for years.
You mentioned the hostages and the war in Gaza, which are, you know, those issues are ongoing. We still have hostages on the ground there. So what are the Israeli people feeling about the lack of attention just over the last few days on those issues? And what are the hostage families in particular feeling and saying?
Yeah, I mean, all I've seen, from everyone is a sense of commitment to this war. I mean, this is truly an all of society effort. I mean, the civilian centers are now coming under enormous fire, and they're suffering casualties. The last count, 24 people have been killed since Friday. And hundreds wounded. Now, that might not sound like a lot, but in a small country it is, and the entirety of those have been civilians. There's no doubt that resolve is wrong, but I think that is a concern in the long term, this sort of way in which Gaza is now seen as the sideshow. And we've even seen that in terms of troop deployment and how the government is thinking about that. I think at some level though, at least some of the people I'm talking to are saying, they don't see these really as discrete wars, right? This is all one big war, and the idea is for Israel to establish security in the region, and itself as the primary player, but more importantly, kind of break this ring of fire that Iran had tried to create around Israel, and of course, Iran is the head of that. So we'll see. I mean, the question, I think, Rebecca, where your question leads is this issue of negotiations and diplomacy.
Right. President Trump, I don't know if you saw just maybe less than an hour ago, was meeting with Prime Minister Carney from Canada, and he confirmed that he had been contacted by the Iranians, that they're interested in negotiating. So has that news made it over there, and how do you feel about that, and how do Israelis see that?
Yeah, no, it has, and Trump said, I think that, Iran knows it's losing. There are a couple of balls in the air here. I mean, I think one is, how far does Israel want to press its advantage? One kind of unanswered question is that of regime change. I mean, is Israel's goal, I just was on a briefing with an IDF spokesperson, and she insisted regime change is not a primary goal, that it's a neutralization of the nuclear threat. But still, I do think regime change is a consideration for Israel, and or creating the conditions for regime change. It's no secret over the last 24 hours that Jerusalem has discussed eliminating the Ayatollah. And President Trump was supposedly against that, but that card is on the table. So I think, there are a lot of possible outcomes here. On the other hand, Israel says it's perfect. If this action does lead Iran back to the negotiating table and to a deal that does take the nuclear option off the table, Israel would be happy with that. So it's like kind of a high variance situation here, where you have a number of possible outcomes.
There are a lot of
And let me just say one more thing, Rebecca,
Sure.
and that is, is the America's capacity, bombing capacity, and you've seen now, this question being raised of will America enter the war in a more kinetic way, to bomb Iran's nuclear facilities. That seems unlikely to me, but I was just talking to a military. He said Israel's biggest bomb is a ton. America has bombs up to 14 tons. So just in a crude way, despite Israel's sort of miraculous efforts, America is capable of kinds of interventions that are just qualitatively different. And there's a th he thinking here that Netanyahu is kind of waiting or baiting Trump to get involved.
Right. Well, if that's, I mean, the two goals of the war, as stated by Netanyahu and the government there, were, right, as you said, neutralization of the nuclear arsenal and also their ballistic capacity. They've done a stellar job on the latter and a fair job of starting the former. But as you say, only America has the equipment to do that. And Fordo is the most trenchant site. So there's a lot of concern in the sort of isolationist right in America that this is where we're headed, and that America would be involved and directly engage. And you're saying you don't feel that that's what's going to happen?
It just feels kind of like sort of a long shot.
So how will Israel reach its goal of neutralizing the nuclear threat diplomatically in the end?
One question would just be, I mean, would Trump need to ask Congress for a declaration of war for something like that? And if he didn't, would that, you know, how would that go over politically, as you say? That would be quite a stunning escalation from America, right? Which basically is kind of standing on the side. I mean, it's helping with defensive capabilities, but not really, you know, joining the fray. I think with a lot of this stuff, you know, I do believe this. And this is what Israel is saying, is they really felt this was, you know, out, you know, point of no return. This was zero hour. And if they didn't act here, Iran was really on the verge of a worst case scenario for Israel. So the imperative to act was there. And I think from Israel's perspective, even if you set them back 2-3 years, that's huge. Yeah. Right. So I don't know if, you know, the question of ultimate neutralization is maybe a goal, but there are other goals along the way, right? And you know, and that has to do not only with the nuclear issue itself, but also the whole regime and setting them back.
Yeah, and Arya, I think it's probably worth noting too that there are other interested parties here besides Israel, right? The Saudis, the UAE, they're not too keen on seeing a nuclear weapon developed in Iran either. And at the moment, from what I've read, the Iranians didn't have the delivery system to use nukes against the Israelis, but they might have been able to deploy them against other countries in the region. So it's not just Israel in that area that benefits from neutralizing the Iranians here.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I mean, Iran had sort of three primary ways of waging war, right? One is the prospective nuclear power. Second is the ballistic missiles, which we've seen, you know, a couple of days, and Israel is now actively working to destroy the launchers that are essential for those missiles. And the third is through its proxies, right, through the Houthis, through Hamas, and through Hezbollah and Iraqi militias and others. So, you know, Israel is kind of going after all three, excuse me, and seeing how much progress it can make. I think you're absolutely right. Although, you know, none of those countries are going to explicitly back Israel publicly. Right. I think they share it. They have a vested interest in its success, for sure.
And another important outcome of this war could be, you know, we sort of alluded to this earlier, the removal of the Ayatollahs and the restoration of Iran to a normalized country, which it really was before the Shah fell. Yeah. And there's talk about the Shah's son coming back. What are you hearing in Israel about what the future of Iran might look like?
Yeah. You know, Israel is always really careful to say, and Bibi is insistent on saying that, you know, the Persian and the Jews enjoy a long, you know, millennia old history, you know, with Cyrus the Great, who allowed the Jews in biblical times to return and rebuild the temple. You know, Iran's population is famously well-educated, Western inclined, by some measures. I think a realistic assessment, though, would be sort of countries rarely have revolutions in the midst of wars from the outside, right? I think it would ultimately be up to the Iranian people. I think Israel thinks that it can create the conditions where regime change are possible, right? That it could kind of discredit the regime, sort of reduce its aspirations, create a kind of domino effect. You know, there were some footage, I don't know if it's verified, of planes taking off from Moscow carrying high regime officials, you know, sort of like Assad did before his regime fell. So, you know, I think there could be a snowball effect there. I don't think it's quite as simple as saying, like, you know, we know that this idea of being greeted as liberators doesn't always turn out to be true, right? And the reality is that Israel is still raining fire on Iran. So I don't know if it's quite as simple as sort of rolling out the red carpet. But this regime is teetering right now under real military pressure. And those reports you mentioned earlier that they want to get to the table suggest that there's a kind of self-preservation involved. Again, you know, there's a famous line that there's no more difficult job in the world than being the prime minister of Israel. You know, one of that is because the Israelis are famously difficult. But two is the decisions you have to make are really difficult. You know, and if you're Prime Minister Netanyahu right now, you know, you have a real choice to make. Is do you press the advantage, or do you hold back? I think partially that's a decision really that'll be made at the White House. I think there's only so long an Israeli prime minister can really directly go against Washington's wishes. So,
We're getting the sense that there are Israelis who feel that this moment would not have happened if President Trump were not in the White House, that Israelis would not have had the leeway to go and do this as they're doing it. And we know now that President Trump was aware of this operation beforehand. What's the media there saying about President Trump right now? What's their feeling about the relationship between Trump and Netanyahu, which was questioned when people thought he was pushing Netanyahu to negotiate with the Iranians? What's the media telling you?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, I think there's no doubt that this operation would not happen if you had an administration more critical in Washington. There's no question that Israel felt comfortable doing this and still feels like it has a free hand. So I think there's appreciation of support. I think that question of how far it goes is a really interesting one. I think it's remarkable that there's open talk about assassinating the Ayatollah, we'll see. Right. With that, I've just gotten an alert.
Time to go.
But
all right, be safe.
We'll talk soon. Okay.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.